Hey, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending upon where in the world you are. Again, this is Eric Rubenstein with Advise Health, and I am Advise's Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, and Abuse, which is just a fancy term, meaning that I help providers with any of their issues relating to fraud, waste, abuse, and compliance issues. This is another episode in the series that I like to call Retro Fraud, where I take a look at essentially fraud schemes that were out there and some compliance failures and things of the sort, and see where those kind of schemes still continue to go on. The past few weeks, I've been interviewing former coworkers of mine who were agents at the OIG. Today, I'm really excited to bring one of the first lawyers that are going to be in the next sort of series of these conversations, Lisa Taylor. Lisa Taylor has been a lawyer in the healthcare, regulatory, fraud, waste, abuse, compliance space for a really long time. I first met Lisa back in about 2004 or 2005. As the result of a case involving the University of Medicine and Dentistry in New Jersey. We're going to talk a little bit about that case and talk about some of the compliance issues that came about as a result of it. Lisa worked as one of the team of lawyers as part of the monitorship that came about as a result of that case. And we're going to talk a little bit about what Lisa's doing today, but I really want to get into the nuts and bolts of having worked for a federal monitor and sort of the things that came about as a result. So Lisa, I'm really excited to have you. We've been talking about doing this for a while. We've been connected for, you know, on and off 15 years. So it's great to have you on. I want to turn the floor over to you for a few minutes and just have you talk a little bit about your background, where you sort of made your bones in healthcare and what you do now for your practice.
Thank you, Eric. It's great to see you, and I appreciate being invited to participate. I really do. I did spend 2 years as counsel to the Federal Monitor of the University of Medicine and Dentistry, UMDNJ, which, for those of your listeners who may not know, was New Jersey's health sciences university. It no longer exists. Parts of it were thrown off to various other state affiliates, including Rutgers. But it was basically part of the state of New Jersey. So the federal government, and we'll talk about that some more in a few minutes. So the federal government was investigating and prosecuting the state government, is essentially what it came down to. I got into healthcare really by chance. When I was in law school, I started working in-house at the Duke University Medical Center Legal Counsel, and then ended up going and working for a physician practice management company. And so then after a clerkship, I started private practice. And back then, no one had any clue as to what health law was. I was at a couple of big firms, and partners would pass me in the hall and say, "What is it that you do?" They would say, do you sue doctors? No. Do you defend doctors? No. Well, what is it that you do? And what I said to them then, and to a certain extent I would still say now, is if you're in the health industry, healthcare is just so unique that whatever you do may impact on something else. So while there are certainly specific things that I do for many of my clients, I'm essentially general counsel, either actual as, you know, as an outside counsel attorney, or, you know, really just, you know, in practice for whatever, you know, for what they need. Of course, I don't do everything for them, but you know, it's important because healthcare is so regulated that an organization, and it's not just a provider, but anyone doing healthcare, doing business with the healthcare industry, doesn't inadvertently end up in a problem because they didn't realize that something that's okay in another industry, like, you know, paying for better shelf space in a grocery store isn't okay for paying for better shelf space in a pharmacy, for example.
Right. Or referral fees, which are sometimes, like, that's always the great example I give, is that a referral fee may exist, you know, for example, if you're purchasing a home and you have a realtor and your realtor refers you to someone else and there's a commission that's paid, it's okay in some industries, but it's not okay in healthcare to pay a referral fee.
Exactly. Exactly. So about 11 years ago, some partners and I formed a boutique firm, which is headquartered in northern New Jersey. It's called Inglesino Webster, which is Scull and Taylor, and it's in Parsippany, New Jersey. But we do practice, we do work all over the country, and I'm actually located in South Florida. And in terms of the work that we do, while we do work aside from healthcare, what I always like to describe the firm's practice is most of our clients either want something from the government, like an approval, a license, you know, that type of thing, or they want to avoid something from the government, like a fine, a penalty, criminal prosecution.
True. Yeah, that's interesting. And so, you know, you've got a pretty good breadth of that regulatory and then compliance background, which is important. And, you know, we were talking a little bit before we got going with this about the fact that people that are lawyers who claim to be in healthcare really need to be healthcare lawyers. They need to understand the vernacular. They need to understand the acronyms, and that really does help to get the process, whatever that process is, moving along that much faster. It really shouldn't be Groundhog Day, you know, like repeating to understand things. You know, if you're sitting down with a client and they're using acronyms and vernacular in the healthcare space, you as the healthcare lawyer, if you're putting yourself out there as one, have to know that vernacular and those acronyms. It shouldn't be that you're sitting across and your client is explaining to you what a UPIC is or the medic or a MAC. This should just be things that are, it's industry of vernacular, it's terms of art. But I want to turn to the whole point of what I thought was really interesting. So from a background perspective, the UMDMJ case, I was the case agent on that case, which came about in about 2004. And it was the result of a QI-TAM or a whistleblower case that was filed by a doctor who was part of the physician staff at University of Medicine and Dentistry, New Jersey, UMDMJ, which, as you explained, was the state's medical school. There were something like 11 or 12 operating divisions. There was a school of osteopathic medicine, University Hospital, which was this level one trauma center in Newark, and then all of these clinics that were around. And the doctor that was at one of the clinics filed a QI-TAM alleging essentially something that they call the 1122 issue. 11 meaning place of service clinic, 22 meaning place of service hospital clinic versus practice. And there was this double billing issue that went on where the doctors from the physician's practice were billing for their services. And at the same time, UMDMJ was billing for those services. And so there were these two bills that were going out with a different place of service, but it was really sort of a traditional double billing scenario. And ultimately, as a result of that, the QI-TAM was ultimately resolved, and UMDMJ paid back a sum of money. It was $5 or $6 million. And as a result of that, there were some things that occurred, the least of which was that UMDMJ had essentially a criminal complaint filed against it. I was the affiant on that. And I remember very vividly doing it because it was really a seminal part of my career, because here I am signing off on a criminal complaint against the state of New Jersey's medical center. And the sort of the background to an extent was that at the time, the governor of the state of New Jersey was a guy named Jim McGreevy, and former Governor McGreevy had put a bunch of people in place running some of the important parts of University Hospital and UMDMJ, who might not have been the most qualified people in the world. And one of the things that was always sort of funny about the case was that every year the hospital has to file a cost report for its Medicare claims under Part A. And for those that don't fully understand what a cost report is, it's essentially like a tax return for Medicare. So it's how much money did you bill, how much did you get paid, and how much are you really owed for your Medicare work. And then there's some Medicaid-related sort of cost reports that go out as well. And one thing that came out during that investigation was that every year the CFO always took vacation, when the cost reports were due and had one of the underlings sign the cost report so that he wasn't ascribing to essentially a false document to CMS. But as part of the resolution of the case, UMDNJ and University Hospital entered into the first deferred prosecution agreement, or what they call a DPA, for essentially a state-operated institution. And as part of that DPA, a federal monitor was put in place for a prescribed number of years to sort of oversee the operations of University Hospital and help with sort of reconstructing the compliance and the general counsel and all of that. A lot of people were not happy because they lost their jobs, and there were some collateral things that sort of came about. But you were the point person for a lot of the things that went on with the quarterly and monthly reporting. I remember getting the binder that would come. The main federal monitor was Judge Stern, who was a retired judge and was a well-known quantity in his firm, and was the monitor. And I remember getting these quarterly binders of things that were going on what was happening with UMDNJ. So tell me a little bit about what some of those, you know, briefly, what some of those day-to-day inner workings were like to clean up what was really, I don't know if I would call it a cesspool of political cronyism, but clearly there were a lot of issues that were at UMDNJ and really at University Hospital.
Thank you, Eric. There were certainly a lot of issues. And in fact, one of the reports, and I can't take credit for coining the phrase, but or writing that report, was it was described as a patronage pit. And I think that, you know, there were a lot of good people who were trying to do the right thing at UMDNJ, but there were also people who were using it for their own ends and means. And the rationale for the deferred prosecution agreement, just so that, you know, just to kind of for background, is that had the federal government actually prosecuted UMDNJ, ultimately, I mean, it would have certainly gone out of business, but the collateral consequences would have been really significant. It was UMDNJ was in great part the core of New Jersey's health system at the time. As you mentioned, there was University Hospital, which was a level one trauma center. There were three medical schools: New Jersey Medical School in Newark, Robert Wood Johnson Medical School in New Brunswick, and then the osteopathic school. There was a school of social work. There was a school of, there was a health sciences school there, you know, that taught other types of healthcare like physical therapy. There was a dental school. And there were all of these clinics throughout the state, including many of the medically underserved inner city areas, such as, you know, Newark, Camden, Patterson. And so if UMDNJ had actually been prosecuted, it would have had to all disappear, because right, they couldn't bill for Medicare, they couldn't bill for Medicaid. Many of these services were provided by Medicare and Medicaid. The ramifications for the students would have been disastrous, because you had students midstream. But if they're going to a school that then is being criminally prosecuted, that would affect the accreditation and the students' eligibility for federal loans.
Right. I think a lot of people also sometimes don't realize, like, for example, University Hospital in Newark is also the largest recipient of what's called DSH payments, or disproportionate share hospital payments, because of the volume of underserved people it has in downtown Newark. And then you've got collaterally the effects of GME, graduate medical education money that comes in through Medicare, through grants. On top of that, forgetting all of that, think about all of the research grants, things like CDC, NIH, maybe some money from FDA. You're talking about a huge collateral effect that the result of a criminal prosecution would have brought upon the state, and how it would have really created a void in collaterally so many other things.
Exactly. Not to mention the fact that a lot of the people at these clinics at University Hospital are local residents and citizens, and they would have lost their jobs. So while the deferred prosecution agreement was novel, it was really a very practical, you know, and at the time, because it had only been used once or twice, a couple of times before. And then U.S. Attorney Christopher Christie, you know, was certainly, I think he had used it once before in connection, perhaps, I think, with a pharmaceutical company. You know, it was really a practical solution to try to address what was a very, very, very serious problem with, and yet trying to mitigate, you know, and control or, you know, all of these, what would have been all of these devastating collateral consequences. But because of the depth of the problem, you know, there was concern that unless there was some sort of ongoing oversight, that things wouldn't just be fixed internally. So that was why former federal judge and former U.S. attorney Herbert J. Stern was appointed as the monitor. And then he had a team of lawyers. I was privileged to be one of them to work with him to carry out the day-to-day work of the monitor. My now partner, John Inglesino, was also part of that team. And that was how John and I first started working together. And in terms of the scope of the work, I used to describe it as everything from A to Z, except that the one thing that we never got involved in was, you know, anything educational. Because there was no reason to think that there were any issues with education and or the education that was being given to students. Most of these, the problems really had to do with the operations of the organization, and in particular, the healthcare operations and the relationships and interrelationships between the university, its healthcare providers, the relationships between the healthcare providers, and then, as I said, organizational issues. So, you know, that.
Now, I just want to go off on a very quick tangent, but, you know, people watching this and listening, if you Google or use whatever internet search engine you want, there was a lot of stuff that happened that we're not talking about. There were some public corruption issues that were down through the School of Osteopathic Medicine involving some bribery issues. There were some things outside of healthcare that all sort of came about to sort of demonstrate that UMDNJ was really a place where there was a lot of patronage-related things going on that weren't all relating to healthcare. There, you've got to keep in mind that a healthcare organization is also a business entity. So there's industry, there's contracts for things like facilities management, supplies, purchasing of food or whatever. And so there's all these collateral things that can potentially come about outside of just the normal healthcare. So I want to fast forward just a little bit, just in the interest of time, because the part that was very important to me was after the monitor was put in place, we on the OIG side and the U.S. Attorney's Office side, we didn't close the case. It was sort of kept open because we were getting these quarterly reports. The AUSA at the time was just an amazing criminal AUSA. She wound up moving on to doing some other things. It went to a couple of other AUSAs who were great. But, you know, ultimately, you got some information while you were in the monitoring role as part of your compliance and cleanup. You get some information about some things that really weren't on your radar, and the story is really kind of an interesting story to me. And then we can, you know, move on, but tell a little bit about how, you know, this information came to you and, you know, ultimately where it was going.
Sure. Well, we did investigate certain things, and there were certain things that we affirmatively knew we needed to look into. But one Sunday afternoon at home, I got a telephone call from a physician who I knew. Surprised he had my home phone number, but anyway, he called me. And he told me that he had been in the physician's locker room at another hospital, and that there was a doctor who was bragging about how he had this great, very lucrative, no-show job at University Hospital. And that was all I was told. But, and the doctor who was calling me just thought, you know, thought I ought to know. I think he was a little bit offended by this other doctor's arrogance, but, you know, and just so shamelessly bragging about how he had this no-show job. But I took it and started digging and digging and digging to try to discover what might be referred to.
Right. And ultimately, what turned out to be the case was that there were a number of doctors who were community cardiologists, most of which were interventional cardiologists, which meant that they could perform catheterizations in what's known as the cath lab for blockages and for stent placement. And the important piece of that is that University Hospital, which was a level one trauma center. And in the state of New Jersey, that means that they have 24-hour staff there to render all phases of healthcare throughout the continuum of healthcare. So they have neurosurgeons on staff, trauma surgeons on staff, cardiologists that are there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And one of the issues with University Hospital was that they had a higher statistical error rate with mortality and morbidity on their cardiothoracic surgeries. And what a little bit of that came down to was that over time, doctors were not bringing their patients there for catheterizations. And there was some statistical significance that for every 10 patients that went into the cath lab, X number would need to be brought up to the OR for a surgery, a bypass surgery, because catheterization wasn't an appropriate intervention. And so because doctors weren't bringing their patients for catheterizations because they didn't want their patients dying in the hospital from the cardiothoracic surgery, they were at risk of losing their level one trauma designation because their morbidity and mortality rates were higher than the average in the state. And so what UMDNJ, what University Hospital did, unbeknownst to everybody, was they went out to the community and they recruited a number of community cardiologists and offered them these robust amounts of money to be what they called CAPS, clinical associate professors, in which they were paid anywhere from $150,000 or $180,000, I think, on the high end, and had these contracts to be CAPS. And your doctor friend was talking to one of the 15 doctors or so that ultimately had one of these agreements, right?
Exactly. And the idea was that these doctors would, you know, get this academic title, because the physicians at University Hospital needed to have an academic title to be able to do work there. And they would bring their patients there. And then, you know, this, if there were more patients and the staff at the hospital got more experience, not only would the volume be sufficient to be able to meet New Jersey Department of Health standards, because the Department of Health also had a requirement that in order to keep licensure for certain services, such as cardiac catheterization and also cardiac surgery, not only would the numbers be sufficient so that the hospital could retain its license to operate and perform that, provide those services, but that these might be healthier patients who didn't end up at the doorstep of University Hospital in the middle of a heart attack or on the verge of a heart attack, but more preventative from suburban areas, who would then come to Newark and they would be healthier patients, and that then that would help the numbers too. The problem
because most of these doctors weren't situated in downtown Newark, where patients that are from lower socioeconomic areas are sort of by default having health access or health issues due to combinations of things. But people in suburban or more affluent areas are typically a healthier group. There's more preventative medicine and the like. So yeah, these were doctors who their feeder patients by default were going to be a healthier group of people. So University Hospital is going to look like rock stars because now they're having these great outcomes, right?
And the doctors and the suburban patients have better insurance. So it would also help the bottom line for University Hospital, and this would defray the cost part of the community of the salaries that were being paid to the community cardiologists. And from a fraud and abuse perspective, there is case law that says that if there's a single, you know, if one of the reasons is to drive referrals, that that's something that's prohibited. You know, trying to enhance outcomes, enhance quality of care, enhance experience, and it's been tied clinically that experienced clinicians have better outcomes, in and of itself, aren't bad things to do. The fact that they were trying to get people who had different experiences involved to be able to care for patients could have been good. But part of the problem was that many of the doctors, if not most of them, actually never provided any services. In fact, that was one of the things that was the most striking, as I kept digging and digging and digging and digging, and it was really like a needle in a haystack. I finally stumbled upon some deposition transcripts that had been taken in a wrongful discharge lawsuit. And one of the doctors, who was one of these community cardiologists, was deposed. And the lawyer for the claimant, former employee, who probably had no clue about any of this, asked if one of these doctors was an employee at University Hospital. And the doctor, you know, said yes. And the doctor was asked what he did. You know, did he do call? Yes, I was asked, but I refused. Did he teach? No, I was too busy. And he went through everything that was, you know, in his job description and in his employment agreement. And in this deposition, the doctor just said, no, he didn't do anything.
Right.
And it didn't mean anything to any of the lawyers involved in this employment case.
Right.
But it was a great big red flag for me.
Right. And, you know, what's interesting is as part of us getting involved with the prosecution, because there were some criminal prosecutions that resulted in some civil prosecutions. The thing that's always been my take home, and I actually teach a little bit about compliance failures in a graduate program that I teach for, is there were something like 14 or 15 doctors, and they were all had contracts that said essentially the same 9 duties. And one of their responsibilities was to teach the fellows who were there for their cardiac fellowship. And if I recall correctly, there were only 2 or 3 fellows in the program. And there were 15 or 10, like the number of community cardiologists was huge compared to the number of fellows. So all of them couldn't have done the teaching, but one of the cases that stood out, there was a doctor by the name of Laxmapathy Garipalli. This is public record. I'm not saying anything that's a secret. He was criminally prosecuted for this. He was hired as a clinical assistant professor, and one of his job duties was to provide education and training to the fellows in the cath lab. Well, that immediately implies that you are an interventional cardiologist. Dr. Garipalli was not an interventional cardiologist. So he couldn't even do the jobs that were listed in his employment contract. But what you were talking about is that sort of resonates with me was the on-call. These were all providers who had robust healthcare practices in which there was no way that they could have taken call. It just would have been an impossible thing for them to do based on the fact that they had this robust practice of their own. In fact, one of the other doctors that was criminally prosecuted was a doctor named Desai, Dr. Bakul Desai. He was so busy in his own practice, seeing patients in his office, that he actually sent one of his underlings to the hospital to do the cardiac catheterizations on his behalf. And so, you know, the thing that was interesting was that these doctors all wound up, they rebuilt if you recall correctly, they built a cath lab out specifically for these doctors. So they had their own cath lab, their own scheduled time, and they were treated differently than other doctors who might have wanted to bring their patients there because they had these fairly lucrative contracts to essentially bring their patients with no other requirements to the job, to the employment contracts that they had.
You're right. For example, while they may have technically been on the call schedule, they actually had first, second, third, and fourth calls. So these community cardiologists, if they were listed at all, were fourth calls. So only if after the doctors who were on the first call, who were, you know, who worked at UMDNJ, or and really, you know, did provide services, and the backup people on the second call, and whoever may have been on the third call, they were all busy. It was, you know, it was a deluge of patients who needed cardiac cath.
Right.
Then and only then would they be called because they were on the fourth call. There weren't enough rooms to do cardiac caths to ever need to get to the third or the fourth call, aside from the fact that other hospitals didn't have third or fourth calls.
Right. The third and fourth call was created to essentially hit one of the bullet points of the employment contract requirements. Now, I recall very vividly that as this was, you know, sort of coming together, that one of the things that you as part of the monitorship were providing us on the investigation and prosecution side were essentially all of the documents that were supporting the absence of the things that were required as part of the employment contract, which made doing these investigations a lot more seamless than in the normal world. Meaning in the normal world, we would find an allegation, we would need documents to support it, we'd have to put together subpoenas, we would then have to find people to talk to and vet and all of this. But as a result of this monitorship that was out there, a lot of that process was much more streamlined because of that sort of regular cadence of communication that existed.
Well, and that was part of the requirement for, as part of the monitor, was that the monitor would cooperate with the U.S. Attorney's Office. And then so we would report to the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the U.S. Attorney's Office would then bring in OIG, and, you know, in order to be able to streamline the efforts of the government agencies, because, you know, ultimately the goal of the U.S. Attorney's Office was to try to right the ship so that then UMDNJ, or, you know, what ultimately became components of Rutgers and Rowan and Cooper Hospital, you know, could ultimately operate and provide really critical education and services to people and jobs to people in New Jersey. You're talking about, you mentioned though a couple about the employment agreements, which brings up a really important point. So often people think, you know, you just have got to paper a transaction or paper a deal. And UMDNJ and the cardiologists' employment agreements really highlight a couple of points. One is that paper if you have paper that looks nice, if you're not really doing what's the right thing, all of the paper in the world isn't going to protect you.
Right.
The other thing is that it's really, really important to know what is in that paper, because all paper is not the same. And whoever is representing you or doing the paper has got to ask the questions and vet the transaction and really make sure that it makes sense. To your point, for example, about there were 16 doctors who had these positions as clinical associate professors or clinical assistant professors, these CAPs, all with the same agreement. If nothing else had been done wrong, the fact that you had 9 doctors for 2 fellows would have been enough to raise eyebrows. Now, teaching fellows requires that, when you teach fellows, you're not sitting in a classroom. It's teaching at the bedside or, in the case of a cardiac, a cardiology or an interventional cardiology fellow, you're teaching, in the cardiac cath lab or in the patient room. But still, the numbers were off.
Right.
It's disproportionate. Right. And so it's really, really important. When people, are looking for professionals and advisors, to consult with people who actually know how healthcare works.
Right. It's interesting you talked about like the paper, and I always use lease agreements as the great example, sublease agreements, right? I have an office, I have an empty room. If I was to bring a lease agreement to a real estate lawyer, that real estate lawyer would say, hey, that looks great. It checks all the boxes. If I bring that same lease to a healthcare lawyer and it's rented at fair market value and everything is enumerated, a healthcare lawyer would go, hey, great, that fits the bill, and then you're good. But the paper is only worth the paper. It's what actually happens behind the paper. So I could sign a lease agreement that says I'm going to be at your office Monday through Friday, 8 to 4. But if I show up for 4 hours every other week, it's the practical application. But what this goes to show is 15 or 16 docs that all had the same contract that was ultimately approved by the then general counsel or someone in compliance just shows you that the fox was watching the hen house on this case. And so, that always resonated with me that, that was an important piece for the monitor to come in to help clean up. We're kind of running out of time, but so in the interest of time, at the end of the day, there were a number of criminal prosecutions. So I talked about Dr. Garipalli. He was criminally prosecuted for the no-show job. Dr. Desai was criminally prosecuted for the no-show job. They also entered into civil settlement agreements. There was a doctor named Ravindra Patel who was criminally prosecuted for some Social Security-related violations. And then there was an accountant by the name of Dilip Patel who was prosecuted for actually false statement, 1001, which I had never seen. It was the Martha Stewart prosecution. And I remember it vividly because he was sitting across from my AUSA at the time, and he just sat across and lied during a proffer. And ultimately, the issue with Dilip Patel was he became the accountant for all of these doctors. And none of these doctors' wives had worked in the U.S., and so they didn't have the required 40 quarters of employment, which is 10 years of full-time employment, to qualify for Social Security. And so what Dilip was telling all of these doctors to do was to offset their salaries to pay their wives. So there was no tax implications. And all these doctors, by the way, made very, very healthy sums of money in their practices, but he would direct them, for example, to take $100,000 off of their salary, pay their wives and their kids. So there's no tax implication, but what there is there's a Social Security implication as a result of that. Interestingly enough, most of the doctors entered into civil settlement agreements. They weren't criminally prosecuted because most of them actually did maybe one thing or two things. Like, a lot of the stuff in the contracts, as you remember, were really nonsense, like show up to grand rounds or present a case. And so we couldn't say that they did nothing. They all kind of did like one or two things you know, when they were pressured to do them. But, you know, ultimately there was one doctor by the name of Joseph Campbell who pleaded not guilty. We had a civil complaint filed against him, and he went to trial. And that was the first False Claims Act trial that anybody could remember occurring in the District of New Jersey. Nobody could remember there being one previously. And it was only the second or third Stark trial, a self-referral trial that occurred. And there were three AUSAs on the case. And in the normal course of business, you may not know this, but in the normal course during trial prep, you know, the case agent is intrinsically involved in trial prep, witness prep, and being part of it. And when this trial prep was going on, it was a civil trial, I was told, don't worry about it. We got it covered. Just show up on the first day of trial. The trial occurred. It did not go well. Stark is very complicated, as you know, and we lost that trial. And in the debriefing, oftentimes when a trial is completed, the judge will go and speak to the jury afterwards and get the jury's opinions about things. And after the case, the judge went and spoke to the jury, and then the judge calls us into chambers to, you know, sort of get, you know, just to talk about the case. They do it to the defense, they do it to the prosecution. And what the judge had told us was that one of the things that triggered the jury to not find in favor of the government was that the government didn't demonstrate what the doctor's referral pattern was before the contract. And I wasn't involved with the preparation of the case, but having been an agent for a number of years and having worked on a number of kickback cases, one of the important pieces that you sometimes have to show in a case is, was that contract the thing that steered the patients? And the prosecutors didn't do that. They didn't show what the referral pattern was. I think, you know, had they shown that, maybe we would have had a difference of opinion. But the other 14 or 15 doctors had settled their cases already. You know, I wonder, looking back now, retro to this, I'm wondering if had that trial occurred earlier, had other doctors not settled, and had we had more trials as a result? But there were a lot of settlements that came about as a result. But the interesting thing, which makes this an interesting retro for me, is in your regulatory world, I'm sure you see contracts that may not be worded the same, but are of a similar nature, where a provider is being asked to come in, whether it be a joint venture, whether it be a subleasing agreement, whether it be something where there's an enumerated list of tasks that are going to be required of that provider, and how much of an eyebrow raiser it brings you, and like saying back to your client, how are you going to document that these things are actually being done to maintain contractual obligations?
Well, exactly. I mean, I always say that a contract is only as good as the people who enter into it. But it's really important because it should set expectations and at least demonstrate what is expected. And, you know, if you're the doctor, then you know what is expected. And if you're the employer, what you should be getting from your employee. But unfortunately, I think that another takeaway from UMDNJ was that many of the people involved weren't, you know, including the lawyers, including the compliance people, they weren't bad people. Unlike some of the people involved who were taking, you know, bribes or, you know, and knowingly, you know, and there were many criminal prosecutions out of this. I think that they just were uninformed and just inexperienced. And it goes back to what I said earlier. It's just critical to know the law, know the requirements, and also understand how it all practically works. Because a bad contract, I mean, if a contract essentially is describing a square peg and operations is a round hole, there's going to be a problem from a compliance perspective.
Yeah, that's a great analogy, because that's true. I mean, at the end of the day, the takeaway for me was that each individual doctor might not have known, hey, I'm one of 16. At some point they do, right? We know that at some point they do. But at the time that they signed the contract, do they think that they're one of 15 or 16, or do they think I'm the only one, or I'm one of two, or I'm one of three? But, you know, if I'm sitting here and I know I'm one of 16 and there's only three fellows, the minute I put ink to paper, I know I can't meet all these qualifications. And so that's the thing, is that at any given time, one of these docs could have raised their hand and said, hey, this is a problem. I can't meet all of these requirements, and withdraw themselves from that, we'll call it the conspiracy, but withdraw themselves from the contract. But none of them did that, because it was free money. I mean, every 2 weeks, the Eagle flew to their bank account and paid them $150,000 or $180,000, which is probably what triggered the one doctor in particular, who was at, by the way, I know where he was. He was at a competing hospital one area over. He was at a hospital in Elizabeth, which borders Newark. And he was actually a known quantity. He's a, you know, he was part of a known quantity. And so, you know, why would you, if your ultimate goal is greed, why would you say, hey, this is not working for me, this is working for me, right? It's free money. And it's interesting because I wonder, had he not said anything, and or more importantly, had he not said anything in the forum that he did, where another doctor who was obviously either angry that he didn't have a similar deal, or really just trying to do the right thing as a physician, had that not happened, and what that doctor who called you's motivation is absolutely irrelevant, but had that doc not opened up his mouth in the manner in which he did, the question is, would that scheme ever have been uncovered?
I don't think so.
Yeah, and I don't know the answer to it, because you can't look as the monitor. You're there to try to fix a million things. And then there's probably a million things that you never know about. And I often wondered that myself, about whether or not that cream would have risen to the top had it not been for one wayward conversation with somebody or overhearing something. And that happens, right? I mean, think about a ketam. Oftentimes a ketam is brought because someone learns something that they might not have known but for the fact that they heard, saw, or were involved in something. It always is, it's happenstance. You just happen to be somewhere that gets you that. Because a lot of these are just by, you know, for that cardiologist, it was opportunity. For being in the physician's locker room, it was just happenstance. That doc happened to just be in the room at the same time that he had the, you know, that happened. So I talk about this case a lot. I talk about the monitorship a lot. I talk about the resulting prosecution of the cardiologists as a result of it, because it really shows that, first of all, the DPA was really just the result of colossal compliance failures along the way. And, you know, obviously, if the 1122 issue was something, what else had been going on from clinical level, from a hospital level, from a DRG level? You know, who knows, right? We just, there's no way to know. Obviously, one of the things that occurred was the breakup of UMDNJ as a singular entity, and the creation of the of things falling under Rutgers and other schools and independents and things of that sort. And the good work that the monitorship did, I think that's one of the resulting pieces, was the fact that this all can't be under one umbrella. The fox cannot watch the hen house. You know, the chief compliance officer reporting to the general counsel, who's got different interests than what compliance might be. I mean, a lot of those things were important pieces. It was interesting years later, obviously, to see that that you and John went off and have this own practice that relies a lot upon the lessons learned and the experiences of having been involved with something that at the time was very, very unique. So you have this very strong historical perspective that a lot of lawyers in the compliance world don't have, because not many lawyers were working as the federal monitor to a state organization under a monitorship and essentially a corporate integrity agreement as a result.
It was certainly, you know, an incredible experience. And, you know, but to this day, there are still people who will not talk to me. as a result.
That's okay.
But that's, you know, okay. That's just one of the, that it just goes with the territory. It was, you know, it, certainly we never had any animus toward anyone. It was just about trying to do the right thing for the students, the employees, and the people who were served by the university.
Right. Right. Well, listen, we're out of time. It was great having you on, Lisa. I always love our conversations. We love seeing you and just being able to chat about things and catch up. I do look forward to having you on again, because I do want to have some other conversations with you just about general compliance things and the sort of the regulatory framework of having really good compliance. I've always said that for a lot of my civil cases I had, not so much the criminal fraud cases, because I think that's a different group, but for a lot of the civil cases, if providers just had even basic compliance, self audits, you know, meeting some of the requirements that the OIG has in their model compliance guidelines, I still think that a lot of the providers that I dealt with in my career as an OIG agent, I would have never met those people. I wholeheartedly believe that. And I think that stepping over a dime to find a quarter that doesn't exist is silly. A penny wise, a pound foolish, whatever you want to call it. So I do want to have another conversation with you about some of the basic compliance things that providers really should be doing, and how you work with some of the clients that you have to ensure that my OIG successors don't come a-knocking. I think it'd be a great conversation for us to have.
That would be great. Thank you so much, Eric. It's always great to talk to you.
You too, Lisa. So for everybody who's tuning in again, feel free to send me an email. Feel free to comment. Let me know some of the discussions you'd like to have on future broadcasts that I do on retro fraud. So till next time, thanks again. This is Eric Rubenstein, the Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, and Abuse for Advise Health.